Okay, so it is my great pleasure to introduce Chris Fuster from the University of York. So he did his PhD in Cambridge in 1995, and then after that he held a postdoc in Bern and a postdoc in York, where he was subsequently appointed a lecturer in 1998. And he's been in York ever since. And by York, I mean York, UK, because for this audience there might be a confusion. And presently, Chris holds a chair in York. He's also serving as an editor in the Journal of General Relativity and Gravitation and in Letters in Mathematical Physics. Now, most importantly, his research is about many interesting things. So mostly it concerns mathematical aspects of quantum field theory and quantum measurement. And he is perhaps best known for his work on quantum energy inequalities. So these, if you haven't heard much about those, so these give local constraints on the negative energy density resulting from quantum field theory. And if you're curious, what is this good for? Well, those give can be used to study things like exotic matter and are relevant if you're interested in things like warp drives, wormholes, and time travel. And these are not just sci-fi tropes. This is real mathematical research. And Chris can tell you more about it maybe after this talk. So he also contributed significantly to development of locally covariant QFT, which is a modern mathematical framework for QFT on curved spacetime. And in the recent years, together with Rainer Fesch, he has been working on developing measurement theory for QFT. And this is going to be the topic of today's talk. So looking forward to it, measurement of quantum fields in curved spacetime. Chris, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Kasia, for the nice introduction. And also thank you to the Perimeter Institute for the invitation. So as the title says, this is a talk about measurement in quantum field theory. It's based on work with Rainer Fesch in this paper in Communications in Mathematical Physics, summarized briefly in a short contribution here. And the second part of the talk is based on a recent preprint with Henning Bostelmann, my colleague in York, and Maximilian Rupp, who is our PhD student and on the call today. So the talk starts really by pointing out a gap in the literature. We all know that measurement theory in quantum mechanics has got a very long and controversial history. But nonetheless, when you're called to give a course to undergraduate students, you don't tend to find great difficulty in writing down some simple rules to teach to them. And it's also the case that the measurement chain has been analyzed to a good extent in quantum measurement theory. So a certain amount is known, even if there are still controversies lying around the place. But when we turn to quantum field theory, things are rather different. When you go from your quantum mechanics course to your quantum field theory course, you suddenly find people have stopped talking about measurement theory. You find that the lecturer doesn't say anything and your textbook doesn't say anything about measurement at all. Quantum measurement theory also rather rarely discusses quantum fields. It's almost entirely written for quantum mechanics. And even where it does talk about quantum field theory, it only talks about quantum fields in flat space time. Now, there is one bunch of people that you would think would have sorted this out long ago. And that is the community of people working on algebraic quantum field theory, which includes me. And this is a theory which is all supposed to be about local observables. So you'd think they would have had it taped. We would have had it nailed by now. But when you look into the literature, you realize that rather little has ever been said about how these things are actually measured. So we claim that there is actually a gap in the literature, which we have decided to put our boot into, and you can work out whether or not it was a good contribution or not. So what I want to do today is give an analysis of the measurement chain in quantum field theory. It's going to be operationally motivated, and it will be covariant. So no coordinates or preferred surfaces or anything like that. It works just as well in curved space-time as it does in flat space-time. There are a number of consistency tests that it passes with flying colors. And importantly, it is a framework that you can actually use to do calculations with. So much for the advertisement. Why is this all difficult in the first place. When you put together relativity, quantum theory, and measurement, there are a number of things which sort of collide. So on the one hand, we know from relativity that the finite speed of light tells us that no measurement can occupy an arbitrarily large volume of space-time. If you are lucky enough to be given a grant, you will only be able to explore a finite region of space-time before you have to report on what you found. So measurements occupy bounded regions in space-time. But when we wheel in quantum mechanics as well, we realize that the measurements can't be performed at points, because if you wish to resolve down to an arbitrarily fine scale, you're going to have to invoke arbitrarily large energies in your measurement apparatus. And so you'll probably end up building a black hole by accident. Another constraint is, of course, that there's no preferred frame in special relativity. So your simple rule that the quantum wave function collapses instantaneously upon a measurement is clearly not going to work at all in quantum field theory. So that has to go out. Well, people have thought about that in the past. And going back to the 1960s and early 1970s, there was a proposal by Helwig and Krauss that says, well, maybe you should say, if you wish to have a collapse of the wave function, that this happens across the backward light cone of the region where the observation is taking place. So that's one thing you can do, and it's Lorentz invariant. But clearly you can't have the instantaneous collapse anymore. Another issue is that simultaneity is relative. If you have two measurements going on at space-like separation, there's no preferred order. So if your rule for updating states says, well, you collapse this one and then that one, it's going to have to be consistent with what would happen if you collapse that one and then this one, because there's no preferred order. And then to crown it all, as we know, when we go to curved space-times, we lose all the symmetries, we might have to deal with non-trivial topology, and everything gets a lot more exciting. So that's why measurement is complicated in quantum field theory, and we're going to see that this can cause problems. If you try to do it by hand, there are all sorts of pitfalls that you might fall into. So here is an interesting one, which goes back to work of Raphael Sorkin in 1993. When I was doing my PhD, I remember this coming out. It was in the early days of the archive, and I excitedly saw this thing and read it and thought, that's really interesting. So I eventually got around to working on it, but it took about 25 years. Anyway, Raphael pointed out that there were apparently no good rules for measurement in quantum field theory. But he says it's easy enough to write some down, and he writes down some natural-looking rules. But then he points out that there's a curious pitfall. Consider three observers. So they have to be in extended regions of space-time by what we've already seen. So Alice, Bob, and Charlie, if you like. They're arranged in such a way that the future of Alice partly overlaps Bob's region. And also the same is true between Bob and Charlie. But Alice and Charlie are space-like separated. So they shouldn't really know anything about each other, even that they're there. But what's pointed out is that a non-selective measurement in region B seems to allow Charlie to determine whether or not Alice has made a measurement or not. Okay, that's Raphael's claim. And this would appear to be some form of superluminal communication. Charlie shouldn't know that there's an Alice at all, never mind whether or not she's doing a measurement. So the conclusion is, obviously, you don't want to let in superluminal communication, so something else has to have gone wrong. And the deduction is that there's something wrong with this measurement B. It is presumably an impossible measurement. But that raises a load of other issues, because who's to say what measurements are allowed and what are not? Okay, the measurement that Raphael looks at doesn't look anything particularly outrageous or anything like that. So we are left with the conclusion Raphael came to, but it became a priori unclear for quantum field theory, which observables can be measured consistent with causality and which can't. And this, furthermore, deprives quantum field theory of any definite measurement theory, and you're reduced, it seems, to a case-by-case analysis. And in fact, people have done case-by-case analyses, and one is listed here from last year. Okay, so I mentioned this, I'll return to it later on, but at this point, partly to show that there are many pitfalls in just trying to extend the rules of quantum mechanical measurement to quantum field theory. And so Rainer and I, when we eventually were embarrassed into doing something about plugging this gap in the literature, decided that instead of trying to invent rules for quantum field theory, we would try to be more systematic and model the measurement process and see what comes out rather than what we want to put in. So the basic idea is this. We're going to take a quantum field theory, which we'll call the system, and another quantum field theory, which we call the probe. And we're going to couple them together in some bounded region of space-time. We'll measure the probe, and we want to interpret the results as a measurement of the system. Now, so that's the basic idea. Of course, we will try to prepare the system and the probe separately. We measure the probe somewhere else, and then we want to interpret the results. Now, this idea about coupling two quantum field theories together is really a proxy for the design of an experiment. It's an idealization. But in case you wonder, well, how can you locally tune two quantum field theories so that they're coupled together in a region? Let me just give you a little example over here. This is sort of a cartoon in a 1+1 dimensional situation. We're going to have four fields in our theory altogether, psi 1, psi 2, phi 1, and phi 2. Phi 1 is going to be our system, phi 2 is going to be our probe, and these auxiliary fields, psi 1 and psi 2, are sort of set up so that in beams that cross. And so because our interaction term is proportional to the product of psi 1 and psi 2, it's only actually switched on inside this crossover region. So effectively, we've managed to make ourselves a tunable and localized coupling between phi 1 and phi 2. Okay, so that's a cartoon example. It's just intended to show that there's something to this idea of coupling two theories together in a local region. Okay, so as I say, we're going to couple these theories together. We're going to measure the probe, but then we want to interpret the results. And we want to interpret them back in terms of the system. We want, instead of saying we prepare the system and the probe, we'll say we prepare the system. Instead of saying, well, we have this funny couple measurement, we'll say that there is some system measurement that we made. And then finally, we'd like to say that the system is now in an updated state, perhaps. So that's the switch in interpretation that we'd like to make after we've measured the probe. So to emphasize this, it's really important that there are two sorts of language here. The actual measurement that you're conducting in a laboratory, if you ever go to such a place, is performed on the coupled theory. That's the thing that is there in the real world. But all the description is given in terms of a fictitious uncoupled theory, where we can talk about the system and the probe to some extent independently. So there's a shift in language, which we'll see replicated in the mathematics in a little while. There's also, of course, an apparent circularity, which I've drawn in an ellipse, naturally. I said I wanted to explain measurement, and I've explained it in terms of measuring something else, the probe. So it seems that we're destined to an eternal regression, that to measure the probe, you have to measure that with coupled to some other probe and so on and so forth. Well, clearly, if we take that line, we will never get anywhere. So I'm going to adopt as a radical working hypothesis the idea that someone somewhere knows how to measure something. Okay, so I'm just going to say that there are measurements in the real world, and our task is to describe them, not to worry about how such things are possible at all, but to describe the way in which they in which we can transfer information from a measurement of a probe to an interpretation as a measurement of the system. That's the game today. Oh, and if you want Latin tag to go with this singularity, I missed it out. It's one of my jokes. Quis metiatur ipsos mensores? Who measures the measurers? Like the famous "Who guards the guards?" quote from Juvenal. Okay, so we cut round that by saying that somebody can measure something somewhere. We're going to describe everything using algebraic quantum field theory. So here is the quick start for that. And if you would like the longer version, I would recommend this little article here written by Kasia and myself. So it has to be excellent, doesn't it? The idea is that a quantum field theory on a spacetime M, which will be globally hyperbolic, is described using a star algebra. So in a star algebra, we can add things together, we can form linear combinations, we can take products, we can form a star like an adjoint, and there is, of course, a unit that when you multiply it by anything, leaves it alone. And importantly, for suitable open regions N in our space-time, there has to be an assignment of subalgebras, which I'll write like this, AMN. And of course, if you ask for the whole space-time, you get back this whole algebra AM. So a typical element in one of these local algebras would be a smeared field. So take a field in the theory, integrate it against a test function that vanishes outside region N. Well, that is something that ought to live in AMN. There are, of course, conditions on the system. Terms and conditions apply. I've written two here, but there are a number of others that you might put in. The obvious one is that to demand is that if you grow your region, then you grow your algebras as well. And this goes by the name of isotony. But another important one for us is that if your region N is big enough that it contains a Cauchy surface for the space-time, then your local algebra is already equal to the whole thing, all right? So all local observables can be part of the algebra containing a Cauchy surface. It's a way of saying that a region of the Cauchy surface determines everything. And that's called the time slice property. The interpretation is that self-adjoint elements of AMN should be interpreted as local, as observables that are localizable in N. When you think about these axioms, you realize that a given element can belong to many of these local algebras. So you can't say it belongs to one and one only, but you can say it certainly is localizable in this region or that region. So that's the interpretation. Of course, we want to talk about states as well. And in AQFT, a state is a map from your algebra of observables to the complex numbers. And its job is to give you the expectation values. So if A is an observable, omega of A is its expectation in that state, omega. Okay, so that's the basics of AQFT. We don't really need to know a lot more than that for this talk. Oh, one thing is that you'll notice that I never mentioned a Lagrangian. I haven't assumed a particular Lagrangian, and I haven't actually even assumed that my theory is derived from a Lagrangian in the first place. So it is a very general framework. So no specific model yet is intended. So now we can describe the idea for the measurement scheme. We're going to have a system theory and a probe theory. They will be A and B on our space-time M. We're going to compare two other theories. What I'll call the uncoupled combination of A and B, which is simply their tensor product, so no further interaction between them. And secondly, a coupled combination of the two theories, with a coupling region which is compact and will be called K. Now, as you remember, I didn't assume a Lagrangian in the first place for any of these theories. And so you might wonder, well, how can you say what is a coupled version of this theory? Normally, you just put in an extra interaction term or something like that. But this is a little bit more general. So I'm going to say what I mean by giving an axiom. And the minimal assumption is really that outside a certain region, which is the causal hull of the coupling region, the intersection of its causal future and causal past, outside that region, all of your local algebras in the coupled theory and the uncoupled theory should be isomorphic. Okay, there should be a way of putting them into correspondence. But more than that, these isomorphisms fit together in a nice way. Namely, they're coherent and compatible with the isotony property I mentioned, which is simply this idea that if you grow your region, you grow your algebras. Okay, so these aren't any old isomorphisms, they're particularly nice ones. So that's the minimal assumption, I would say, about what a coupled version of A and B is that differs from them inside this coupling region K. So once we've done that, we can now proceed as follows. If I take my region K, I can excise its causal future from space-time, and what I'm left with is a covariantly defined in region. Okay, no coordinates needed, it's just there. Likewise, I could excise the causal past, and what I'm left with is a natural out region. So I have those just for free. In a globally hyperbolic space-time, these regions must contain Cauchy surfaces for the whole space-time. And because they do, there are then isomorphisms, tau plus and minus, between the uncoupled theory on the whole space-time and the coupled theory on the whole space-time. And here's the proof. Using the time slice axiom, I can already say that the whole algebra for the uncoupled system is equal to the local algebra for either for the out region, say. But by our assumption on the coupled theory, since the out region is outside the interaction region, there's an isomorphism with the coupled theory on the out region. And by the time slice axiom for that theory, we now get ourselves to the coupled theory on the whole space-time. So there is an isomorphism associated with the out region, and likewise there's an isomorphism associated with the in region. So two isomorphisms, and while we're passing the time, we can of course put them together, jump from the uncoupled to the coupled and back again, and that will give us something we'll call the scattering operator. And I should emphasize, just because it will come up later, that the ordering here is that we do the out region first. So we hop over at late times and then we hop back at early times. That's the way, the convention that we're adopting. For free, from our assumptions, we get a locality property, which is that this scattering operator acts trivially, like the identity operator, on a like identity map, on any local region in the causal complement of the coupling region. Okay, so that is something very useful that comes up a number of times. Now, here we come to the main idea. It comes with the slogan, prepare early and measure late. And we're going to use these tau plus and minus to convert between fictitious uncoupled language and the coupled language of the real system that you measure. So here's an uncoupled statement. We prepare the system and probe in states omega and sigma at early times. Okay, we're talking about them as if we can talk independently about the system and the probe. Now, in the uncoupled theory, we know exactly what state that is. It's a tensor product. But we want to translate that to the coupled theory. And since this preparation was supposed to be done at early times, we use the map tau minus. And this is the formula for how you translate from one side to the other. At late times, we want to measure a probe observable. That's another statement about the uncoupled, in uncoupled language. And because, and in the uncoupled theory, we know exactly what sort of observable that is. It's unit tensor B. for B in the probe theory. Well, we want to do this at late times, so we translate across using the tall plus map this time. Okay, so now we know what observable we're going to measure on our coupled theory, and we know in what state we're going to measure it. So we know what the expectation value will be, it's given by this expression here, but we want to interpret the result in terms of the uncoupled theory. So what we now need is to find an observable in the system theory whose expectation in the original state is equal to the one for the actual measurement. Okay, that's what we're going to look for. And if we can do that, we could say that our measurement of this coupled system has succeeded in measuring observable A. Well, there's a formula for that. And since this is a colloquium, I'm not going to dwell too much on the details of it, except to say there is an explicit formula for how you do it. And this can be turned into a map, epsilon sub sigma. Sigma is the preparation state of the probe that maps between the probe observables and the system observables. And we will call this the system observable induced by B. Okay. So what properties can we read off from this whole thing? Well, an important question is, what is the localization of the induced observable? And we can get that out of this localization property of the scattering map in the following way. If we firstly think about an observable, that the probe observable that's space-like separated from the coupling region, okay? Then one can compute what is epsilon sigma of such an observable, and it turns out to be a multiple of the unit. In other words, it's a trivial observable. It doesn't tell you anything about the system at all. It just tells you about the probe observable and the preparation state for the probe. But that's good, because you shouldn't really be able to find out anything about the system when you're measuring something space-like to where the system and probe were coupled together. So that's a nice consistency result. But we can say a bit more, which is that, at least assuming that we have something we'll call a Haag property of the system theory, then the induced observable always can be localized in any open, connected, and causally convex set containing the coupling region. Okay, so we know where they live, and where they live is very close to the coupling region. You might have thought, well, when you measure the probe, whenever you get around to it, maybe that's where the system observable is located. But no, it's in the coupling region. Okay, so to give you a sort of pictorial one, if you measure the CMB background now, that is in some sense a coupling between photons and matter on the surface of last scattering. So effectively, you are measuring an observable localized on the surface of last scattering. Okay, so that's a sort of way of thinking about a fairly extreme version of this localization property. So we know where these induced observables live. Something else we can read off is the following. We, by construction, arrange that the induced observable should have the same expectation value as the true observable in the real coupled system. This map, epsilon sigma, has some properties. It maps the unit to the unit. It maps adjoints to adjoints. So in particular, self-adjoint things get mapped to self-adjoint things. That's good too. But it isn't a homomorphism in general. And what you can say, however, is that if I have something which is of the form, if I take epsilon sigma of B and form this combination here, it will be dominated by what I would get if I applied epsilon sigma to B star B. And this has a consequence, which is that the true measurement, the one that actually happens in the lab, has a greater variance than this hypothetical one. And there's a good reason for that. it's detector fluctuations. So we see this coming out quite nicely from the formalism. This can also be seen when we look at a particular sort of observable called an effect. Now, an effect is a yes-no observable or true-false observable. Technically, it's given by an algebra element, which is positive, and so that 1 minus b is also positive. And so then the probability of getting this to come out true or to be successful is omega of b in state omega, and the probability of failure or it coming out false is omega of 1 minus b. So this is a sort of, as I say, a yes-no observable. If b happens to be a projection, then it's a sharp measurement with zero variance. But otherwise, it's an unsharp measurement, an unsharp effect. Now, this property I mentioned before, that epsilon sigma is positive, in fact, it's even completely positive, but not a homomorphism, means on the one hand that any effect, a probe effect, gets mapped to a system effect. Okay, so we still have a yes-no observable, but because it isn't a homomorphism, the system effect that's induced is typically unsharp, even if you start with a sharp effect in the probe. So this should make people who like quantum information and positive operator valued measures very happy, because they've always known that that's the better way of talking about measurements than projection valued measures. Okay, again, this comes out of the formalism, as it does in quantum measurement theory. This is a very similar phenomenon there. So summarizing to this point, what I've shown you is that to every probe observable and probe preparation state, there is an induced system observable, and it can be localized in or around the coupling region, okay, or the causal hull of the coupling region. It has the same expectation value as the true measurement, but the true measurement has greater variance because of detector fluctuations. And also, if you were to take a probe observable that's localizable in the causal complement of the coupling region, you have a trivial system observable. Okay, so that's so much for observables. If there are any questions now, it would be there's a natural pause. No? Okay, let's keep going. Oh, sorry, the last point. This all justifies the interpretation of the local algebras as being those observables that are measurable within the region we're talking about, in the sense that that's where the coupling takes place. Okay. Ah, yes.
Yeah, a little question. Your map epsilon depends on the choice of the initial state sigma.
Yes. Yes, that's correct.
Suppose you change the initial state in the system, but not the probe. Does it still depend on it?
Oh, sorry. So sigma is the probe preparation state.
Oh, the probe preparation state only depends on it. So sigma only is only the probe preparation.
Yes, that's important. Yeah. So it's part of the measurement apparatus is how you set up the probe in the first place. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, actually, states is where we're going now, and in particular, the question of state update rules. And we all know what they are supposed to be in quantum mechanics, and it comes with all of this stuff about instantaneous collapse of the wave function. How can we take this over to quantum field theory, even more in curved spacetimes? Well, the ideology we're following is the operational one. So rather than try to think what the right rule might be, let's think, what is its purpose? What is the purpose of the updated state? And its clear purpose is to facilitate prediction. That's what it's for. And we know this actually from quantum mechanics. Here's the elementary rule. If you have a measurement of a observable A and it results in a non-degenerate eigenvalue lambda, then the state immediately afterwards is the corresponding normalized eigenvector. So that's the rule. What it means is, what its significance is that if we measure another observable, B, immediately afterwards, well, the expected value coming out of that measurement is given by the Born rule using this vector phi sub lambda, okay? Now, when I say expectation value, of course, I have some sort of ensemble in mind. And this is, in this case, the ensemble of all identical measurements, experiments rather, in which A returned the value lambda. That's what we're averaging over. Alternatively, and equivalently, I could consider the full ensemble of all measurements of A followed by B. And then the content of this update rule is that the conditional expectation of B, given that A returned the value lambda, is given by the Born rule with this state phi sub lambda. Okay, so it's about telling you what the conditional expectation is given some knowledge about a measurement that has occurred. So let's look at it in our framework. Take two probes. They're independent, and they are going to each measure an effect. Well, we could think of this as a single experiment, and if you like, a super probe consisting of the two things. And those two effects could be combined as the effect A and B, which is successful if both of them are successful. Okay, so that's a way of putting them together. And mathematically, you'd use the tensor product to reflect that. So now let's look at this conditional expectation. The conditional expectation of B, given that A was successful, is by Bayes' rule just the ratio of the expected value, the expectation that both are successful, divided by the probability that A has been successful by itself. And the advantage of doing this is that on the right-hand side, we have statements about measurements by a single probe. Okay, so the one that's highlighted there is about the probe A by itself, and the numerator is a statement about this super probe. Okay, this sort of combined thing, but it's just some probe, if you think of it, all in one go. And we already know how to describe measurements by a single probe, so we turn the handle and out comes a formula for the conditional expectation value. We now have probe preparation states for A and for B, and here are the two effects sitting there. Theta A is the scattering map for the A probe by itself, and theta AB is the scattering map for the combined probe. Okay. Well, this expression doesn't really speak to you deeply, and we're going to have to do something to it in order to get something useful out. Well, we need to assume something more, actually, about where these probes are in space-time. So let's, as a matter of definition, say that whenever we have two coupling regions that can be separated by a Cauchy surface, they will be regarded as causally orderable. Okay, so in this picture here, there's a, one might say, a clear causal order that K2 is after K1. And this picture here, well, it's a little bit more arguable, okay, because there are two ways of drawing a Cauchy surface between these two regions. They're space-like separated. But it's still the case that one can make an ordering in which K2 comes before K1. So some observers, at least, will think K2 is earlier. It's also possible to have an ordering in which K1 comes before K2, and other observers think that one was earlier. Well, orderable means just that. You may put an order on them. It may be that there's more than one order that can be put on, consistent with causality. And we can extend this to n regions, and we'll say that these n regions are causally orderable if you can label them so that there's a causal, so there's a Cauchy surface between consecutive pairs all the way along. Any labeling for which you can do this is something I will call a compatible causal order, and I'll write it with these dainty-looking triangles, okay, to indicate that there's some order. But there could be another order also, which is compatible with these regions. Okay. So now the assumption is something called causal factorization, which is that if your coupling regions are causally orderable and Ka can be put to the past of some Cauchy surface between it and Kb, then the combined scattering map should factorize. And it factorizes into a piece which is, excuse me, only about the B probe, the later one, followed by a piece which is only about the A probe, the earlier one. And this is because, remember, our scattering map is defined by from the past to the future in our convention. So this is the right way round. Obviously, if you've got two space-like separated regions, then both orderings are possible. And so this causal factorization applies in both orders. In other words, those two scattering maps have to commute with one another. So let's assume that causal factorization applies, and it does in many models. It's related to Bogoliubov's formula in perturbation theory, for example. But if we do that, that rather unprepossessing formula for the conditional expectation value that we had a couple of slides ago can actually be teased apart in such a way that it becomes the ordinary expectation value of our effect B in a different state. Okay, so the conditional expectation conditioned on success of A is an expectation of B in a different state. And the different state, one can find the formula, and notice that this omega A does not depend on anything to do with the B probe. It doesn't depend on its scattering or its preparation state or the probe observable. Okay, it's purely about system A, Alice, if you like. So what does this mean? Well, this is, if you like, a derivation of a state update rule, which says that given a successful measurement of A, we can update the state from omega to omega sub A, given by this formula here. But I really want to emphasize that it is not necessary to assume that the actual state of the real world changes in this process. What's going on here is this update rule is conveniently doing some bookkeeping for you. It's the bookkeeping needed to compute a conditional expectation value, okay, given the additional knowledge from the A measurement. It's accountancy. And I like a good accountant as much as the next person, but I don't see a reason to elevate accountancy to a fundamental physical principle. Okay. So there is no need to actually assume that the state changes. On the other hand, you can if you wish. So that is the update. What are its properties? Well, the first, since it's nearly Halloween, I give you unspooky action at a distance. Okay. So you might think, well, space-like separated from the measurement region, can this updated state change the expectation value of some observable? And you might, in the first case, actually someone is shaking their head, which shows they've got good judgment. And they like my jokes too. So if you think about it, however, you might actually come to a different conclusion. And the theorem, so this is actually what's true, is that if you're localizable in the causal complement of the coupling region, the expectation value is unchanged if and only if this observable B that we're talking about is uncorrelated with the induced system observable in the original state. Okay? Correlation at space-like separation is nothing mysterious at all. If there are two envelopes, one with a blue postcard in it, one with a red postcard in it, one sent to Waterloo, one sent to York, and I get the red one, I know the blue one has turned up in Waterloo, assuming your postal service is up to it. Okay, there's nothing spooky about that, it's just correlation. And this is what we see here. So it's unspooky action at a distance, and it's exactly the right sort of unspooky action at a distance. There's also a consistency property. Suppose you have two of these things going on at space-like separation. as I said earlier, there's no defined order. So I could update according to effect A first and then effect B after, or I could do it the other way around. When you do the calculation, you find that these states agree. So it passes this consistency test. And you can extend all of this to multiple causally orderable probes with a suitably extended notion of causal factorization. Now we can take the conditional expectation of B, given that A1 and A2 and A3 and so on up to AN all were successful in state omega. And this is a ordinary expectation value of B in a modified state. What is the state? When you do the calculation, you find that it is a successively updated state. Okay, using the same rule, over and over again, first for A1, then for A2, then for on so on and so forth, up to AN, if they have been ordered so that K1 is before K2 is before K3, and so on is before KB, the coupling region for this B observable, at least in some causal ordering. And importantly, this formula is true for all compatible causal orderings you can write down. So that's the selective measurement. What about non-selective? So non-selective, of course, is when you make no selection. Okay, we make the measurement A, but we do not do any data analysis conditioning on the success of the A measurement. And under those circumstances, the updated state is an appropriate convex combination of the updated state for success and the updated state for failure of the A measurement. And when you do the calculation, you find that the appropriate non-selective update map can be written in this form here. Now, I'm not going into the details of what the weights are, but actually just the denominators all being cancelled off. And notice that here we have A, and here we have 1 minus A, and the A's cancel out. So what you're left with in the end is an expression, which of course depends on the scattering map for the A probe and the preparation state for the A probe, but it does not depend on the particular effect A that you thought you were trying to measure. So that's the non-selective update rule. And this is something that I call the principle of blissful ignorance, okay? And it's a theorem, which is that now, if you look at space-like separation, take B, which is space-like separator from the coupling region, its expectation in the non-selective, the updated state omega NSA, is the same as it was before, okay? If it's non-selective, that means that nobody ever does any selection on the result of the A measurement. You never get to find out what it was. It's in your causal complement. It's just as well that the expectation value does not change under these circumstances. It's different from what happened when it's selective measurement, because in selective measurement, you get to find out, or at least potentially, what the result was. So, multiple non-selective measurements. So now let's consider a whole bunch of things. We've got what we might call Team Alice, a whole bunch A1 up to AM, and Team Charlie, C1 up to CN, and somebody in the middle that might as well be called Bob, KB. So we're going to measure, Team Alice and Team Charlie all measure their effects without selection. Do the calculation. The expected value of B in our original state, okay, is equal to the expectation value of B in this non-selectively updated state. And notice that we only need to take Team Alice into consideration here. It's only the things that were in the past of KB that enter, according to any compatible causal ordering. The non-selective measurement to the future, Team Charlie, is irrelevant to this calculation. And so it can be ignored, and just as well, because you're trying to make a, poor old Bob is trying to make a prediction of something, and he doesn't want to have to know about things that haven't happened yet, or in his causal complement. So this is true for any causal ordering. So you can cut the cake any way you like, consistent with causality. And this brings us to the impossible measurement. Kasia, how long do I have?
Well, I think according to the 1 hour rule, you have about 8 minutes.
That's fine. Okay, time for some impossible measurements then. So coming back to Raphael's nice example that I mentioned earlier on, here are Alice, Bob, and Charlie again. And Alice's future overlaps Bob. Charlie's past, it overlaps Bob, but Alice and Charlie are space-like separated, so shouldn't know about each other. Alice gets to choose, whoops, whether or not she makes a non-selective measurement. Bob is definitely going to make a non-selective measurement. And the question is, can Charlie determine whether or not Alice performed her experiment or not? In other words, is the non-selective expectation value for A and B applied to Charlie's observable equal or not to the rule when we only have Bob's experiment to do the update with? That's the question. If they are always equal, then Charlie cannot tell. So we analyzed this situation in the framework. The A and B observables can be modeled using probes. And here is a little bit more of a detailed picture of what's going on. You have to go a little more deeply into the properties of the scattering map than I have told you. But when you do, and so with no further assumptions, just a little bit more work, you discover that Bob's scattering map, acting on Charlie's observable, can be localized in this region N, the algebra associated with this region N. And N is a region that is simultaneously in the causal complement of Alice's coupling region and in Bob's in region. Okay, that's what's going on here. And it follows now immediately from things I have told you that Charlie cannot determine whether or not Alice has measured. So let's look and see why. Here is the update rule for both Alice and Bob. So in the case where they're both measuring, and the formula involves theta A and theta B, both acting on Charlie's observable. Now, because of what I just said, this part of the expression, this lives in region N up here. It's in the causal complement of Alice's region. So Alice's scattering map acts trivially. So we can throw it away. And we get down to this expression here. We remember that, of course, Bob's scattering map acts trivially on Alice's probe system anyway. And therefore, this sigma A just will take the expectation value directly on the unit. So it falls out, it's just a factor of one. And what we're left with is omega sigma B, Bob's scattering map on Charlie's observable tensor, the unit. And that is the formula for the expectation value in the non-selective updated state when only Bob is on the case. Okay, so Charlie cannot tell. There are no impossible measurements in this framework. So there are no pathologies of the sort that Raphael pointed out you have to be careful with. What's the key assumption that makes it work? It is locality, an assumption that the probes and the couplings are all described by physics that respects locality. So turn it around. If you want to find an impossible measurement, you can only do it using apparatus that does not respect locality. In other words, impossible measurements can only be performed using impossible apparatus. So that's the slogan for this part of the talk. And now, Kasia, how long do I have?
Three more minutes.
Three more minutes. Okay, so you get the bonus slides then. So I wasn't quite expecting to get to this point. I also want to show you that we can use this for calculation. Okay, here is a specific model. Two free scalar fields. One is going to the system and one is going to be the probe. And we put a very simple interaction term in. Rho here is a compactly supported test function, and this defines the coupling region. The equations of motion are linear, so everything can be solved, at least in principle. Quantization is unproblematic, and we can, in fact, even write down the scattering map. It's convenient to do it using generating functions, and when you, as it were, formal power series, the generating function for psi smeared against H, you find this tensor product of other generating functions. And F minus here is supported in the intersection of the coupling control rho and the causal past of our H. So if we're starting with psi H, probe observable smeared with H, this is where F minus lives, and H minus, or at least the difference between H minus and H, also lives down there. Okay, so one can give more or less explicit expressions in terms of green functions, but the important thing is where they live. If you know the scattering map, you can compute the induced system observable, again in the sense of generating functions, and it comes out to be the generating function for the field phi, your system field, smeared against the F minus, with a factor that is determined by the probe. Okay, S here is the two-point function of the probe preparation state, and so we have a sort of mixing up of things. If you like, it is actually a blurring out. If you compute what the induced observable corresponding to a smeared field is, smeared probe field, it's a smeared system field, but replace H by F minus. We'll look at the square, and there's an additional term, which is to do with the probe preparation state. And so when we look at variances, we find that although the expectations match, the variance of the true measurement is slightly bigger than the variance of the hypothetical one, and the excess is a two-point function of the probe preparation state. It's about detector fluctuations. Okay. And I think I'm actually, 30 seconds or not?
30 seconds, yes.
30 seconds. All right, here's a famous one, the Unruh-DeWitt detector. Okay, remember you have an accelerated detector. Let's suppose that we have a temporary coupling between the detector and the probe along the world line. Well, then the localization region for the observables will be this diamond here. But if you eternally couple the probe to the probe in the field, you've got no better than the wedge. So the observables you measure of an eternally coupled Unruh-DeWitt detector have huge localization. They're localized over the whole of the wedge. Okay, so that's one example of how this all fits together. And now we come to the summary. So I hope I have shown you that the operational framework of quantum measurement theory can be adapted to AQFT in flat and curved space times. Very minimal assumptions going in, and everything is covariant. Importantly, you get local system observables coming out. They live near the coupling, where the coupling is. We've derived state update rules rather than positing them. We've got consistency against very many pathologies, including the impossible measurement problem. And we have the principle of blissful ignorance to enjoy in our spare time. And even more, we've been able to show that this is something where you can actually compute things. So with that, I'll thank you for your attention.
Yeah, let's thank Chris for the very nice talk. So it's clearly the time's up.
Yes.
Thanks for keeping the time. So traditionally, first we allowed the PhD students and master students to ask questions. So the floor is open for young generation.
I had a question related to the applicability of what you worked out here to curved spacetimes.
Yes.
Is the rationale that your the algebra associated with the algebra of observables associated with a region can be restricted to a sufficiently small region that you might as well be working in flat spacetime?
No, it's actually that even in a curved spacetime, to every local region, there should be a local algebra, okay? Where the dynamics is just given by the local geometry of that space-time region. So we definitely don't need to assume that we're almost in flat space-time. This is a genuinely curved space-time theory.
Thank you.
I do have a question. Well, first of all, thank you so much for the presentation. It was very, very clear and enlightening. But in the beginning, you said that you would assume that somewhere else would know how to measure something, right? And that sort of stuck with me in the sense that in the end, what you're doing is sort of allowing two quantum fields to interact briefly, and then somehow developing a measurement scheme for one of them and trying to infer properties about the other one, if you want, right? So, and that's a very, very good idea. That's very interesting. But I guess that my question is pretty much, what's the difference between, what are the clear differences between what you're doing here and considering simply interacting quantum field theories?
Well, in a sense, I'm idealizing a little bit. In the real world, let's suppose it's all described by the standard model, you don't get to choose what the theory is. Okay, it is the theory that it is. However, we are quite good at isolating bits of this model and using it to talk about other bits. So, for example, we let photons and electrons scatter from one another and things like that. And so this is the sense in which you would make it less idealized. You would say, well, within some interacting theory, try to identify sectors which can be regarded as more or less independent constituents of the theory. Engineer by a choice of state, maybe by boundary conditions, by other things, that these, the interaction between electrons and photons is always switched on, but engineer that in your particular instance, it's particularly strong in the interaction region inside your experiment, which you do by setting up a beam of electrons and a beam of photons, and they actually cross. Okay, that's how you would do it. Of course, it's a lot harder to describe. And so what we've done is take this idealized view that these two theories, two independent theories, are coupled in a compact region, okay? But you could take that as a proxy for the more complicated and realistic framework with a single interacting theory behind it.
Any more questions? Yes, Ivan.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you very much for the talk. I just wanted to, maybe following up on the previous question, I don't know in algebraic quantum field theory how plausible it is to understand quantum mechanical systems, like quantum mechanical systems understood as quantum field theories on some world line, and how that could be a special subcase of what you just presented. It's just understanding the two quantum field theories, but one quantum field theory only supported on this line.
This is actually what Rainer and I were trying to do in the first place. We wanted to describe the Unruh-DeWitt detector in a clear way. So indeed, you might think, well, it's like a theory, like a quantum field theory, which is, if you like, one plus naught dimensional. Okay, it's got time, but it's not going to have all of the spatial dependency. So, well, you can do that. You then run into some interesting questions, because it's almost as if you've got a space-time for the probe, which has just got time, and you've got a space-time for everything else, which is usual space-time. So you have to sort of couple together things across two different sorts of space-times. And, well, you can do that. The problem is that the interaction, if you really make it on a line, it's a bit singular. And so it's actually too singular to really make good sense out of. But you certainly could imagine that it's concentrated, it's actually got spatial extent, but it's concentrated around a curve. Okay. And well, this was what we were working up to. And in the meantime, we began thinking more and more about the way that the measurement theory would work. And then rather than present all of this in one go, which would just be far too much, we decided, well, just have two quantum field theories on the same space-time manifold. So you cut out that bit of complexity with a nice sort of a localized but not at all singular interaction, which cuts out the other problem. So this is a sort of warm-up, if you like, to what the proper Unruh-DeWitt system is. But the literally coupling on a world line is too singular. Okay, so that is just too formal. But you can get close to it. And in our paper, by the way, we actually explain how you can sort of do a first-order perturbative version of what we say. So what we do is not necessarily, doesn't have to be perturbative, but you can do a perturbative analysis, and you can actually see the formulae that you normally get coming out of the Unruh-DeWitt detector analysis. You can see them emerging. So with suitable approximations, you can see where those formulae come from, okay? But in our framework, you have to make some idealizations to get down to that. But as I say, you would have trouble making the literal Unruh-DeWitt detector system rigorous anyway, because it's too singular for that.
That problematic looks very similar to what happens when people do computations with Wilson loops, and they have to introduce some framing of the loop, right? Some regularization procedure for framing the whole loop to mm-hmm. make it work. Okay, thank you very much, Professor. It was a very good talk.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any more questions from the slightly more junior part of the audience? Okay, I don't see any. I can. Oh, Rafael, you're not a student, but yes,
I understand what you asked.
I will open the floor now for everyone. So yes, please go ahead. Rafael, you can go ahead.
I had several questions, so I'm trying to think which one to begin with. But let's go back to the original question about impossible measurements. So you have shown in a very nice way that impossible measurements are truly impossible. The question is, do we know which measurements concretely are possible and which are not? I mean, for example, you kind of indicated that maybe it's true that no projective measurement at all is possible. I don't know if that's it. You want to go that far.
Well,
if we had a particular measurement we would like to consider, is there something here that will let us judge whether or not it's in the possible category
This is actually one of the open issues. So you have this map epsilon sigma. It maps from the probe observables to the system observables. We know in the model I described that it gives you a subalgebra, but we don't know really whether, in a sense, how big it is. And that's one of the things Maximilian is working on. We think actually it's maybe getting up towards dense. So in some sense, or a large class of observables might be obtainable in this way. Now, so of course, that doesn't mean that there are none that aren't. It just means that you probably wouldn't know. I mean, for a particular observable, up to any approximation, it might as well be one that is possible in this way. So I would say that in quantum measurement theory, in quantum mechanics, there are results that allow you to say that all observables can be obtained by one of these measurement schemes. These are somewhat abstract C-star algebraic results, and I'm not totally happy with using them in this context, because I want there to be some sort of physical model behind this. So I wouldn't be completely happy with an abstract result which says that Zorn's lemma tells you that there has to be a quantum field theory out there that will allow you to measure this thing. That's not going to satisfy me. So what we're trying to do is work with particular models and see what can come out of this. But pragmatically, the answer is that anything you actually can measure is possible.
But it sounds like a tautology, but anything that you can measure.
Yes, it says, well, the physically relevant observables are surely the ones for which there is an apparatus. It's not quite a tautology, right? Because what I'm saying is, if there is an apparatus that will measure this thing, then it cannot give you an impossible measurement pathology.
Okay.
Yeah, so all of those ones, those are the ones that are actually
If you selected an arbitrary observable out of your local algebra, my sense is that it would not be possible. Are you saying that you think that the possible ones are dense in the local algebra?
It is. Something in that direction. It may be that there's a dense set of generators or something like that, but we're not done with this. It's not even that we're writing up the results. That's ongoing work, but there is reason to hope that it's quite large.
I see. So in a more positive direction, I remember thinking that anything which could be written, this would be too singular for you, I think, but anything that could be written as a sum of local observables or integrals of point observables on a portion of a Cauchy surface, that should be safe. Mm-hmm. So is there anything like that you see?
I would believe that. And I would believe it because it suggests that there is... I actually do believe that. I wouldn't necessarily think of it in terms of integrals on Cauchy surfaces, because, as you say, that might be a bit singular. But if we look at the screen, if you look at the Bob region, if you can take apart Bob's observable and decompose it into bits that see Alice's future but do not intersect Charlie's past, okay? And bits that intersect Charlie's past but do not intersect Alice's, then things are quite easy, I think. Okay, so that would be an example of that argument. So for many observables, you might think straight away, well, that already gives you a big class of things. So that's not about them being induced observables as such, but it is possibly about them being unproblematic from the impossible measurements perspective. Because, of course, what we've shown is that everything that you can get as an induced observable is unproblematic. That doesn't mean that there are also other things that are also unproblematic. So the unproblematic observables are at least as big as the range of this epsilon sigma map. Okay, and I think that this teasing apart argument, which would be some a little bit like additivity, but a bit not quite, a little related to what we call additivity in algebraic quantum field theory, goes a long way towards giving you more observables that are unproblematic.
I guess it is something like locality, right? I mean, like you could, in perturbative AQFT, you'd have local functionals, which obviously are those which can be decomposed into these little bits. Yes. So it is some sort of like a more, you know, abstract quantum notion of what local is.
Yes. So the ability to take things apart, which is this sort of additivity idea. I mean, it's, by the way, no surprise, of course, that PAQFT seems to fit quite nicely alongside this, because they, in a way, come from very much the same stable, and they both got...
Same people.
Same background, and locality, of course, at the core.
Rafael, do you have more questions?
Well, I have a long list, but I thought I would let someone else, if someone...
Okay. So let's give somebody else a chance. Yes, I don't... DJ?
Yeah, hi. Hi, Chris. Hi. So my question is a follow-up on Rafael's question. So something that's not clear to me is in this picture, if I take the region of B, and I consider, say, an arbitrary element of the algebra. How do I know if I can decompose it into, you know, the bits of, and pieces you mentioned? Should I expect generically I cannot do the decomposition, or should I expect the opposite?
Right. So, depending on the theory you've got might just allow those sorts of decompositions. Okay, that it could be a property of the theory. But more generally, what we've shown is that the observables relevant to physics, in other words, the ones that can be measured using an apparatus, are unproblematic. Okay, so whether or not they can be taken apart, they cause no problems in relation to this, to the impossible measurement scenario. Okay, so it's not actually necessary to know whether a given observable can be taken apart. The discussion with Rafael just there is that if you can, if it does happen that it can be taken apart, then I think also that would be another way of proving that that particular observable was immune to impossible measurements.
When you say the answer depends on my theory, do you mean something like if I have a free scalar field theory or if I have a QED?
I would expect a theory which is based on fields and formulated in a field-friendly way, things can be taken apart usually, because the generators decompose, right? Phi of F can be decomposed as a, you know, by chopping up the test function. Not too violently, but if you can do that smoothly enough and still get around the problem, then you'll be fine. And that's why this, by the way, this extension actually comes to your help in this case, because there's a little bit, there always has to be a bit of a gap between Alice's future and Charlie's past. And so in this, now you can sort of smoothly turn off the piece that's going to be left on Alice's side and the piece that's left on Charlie's side. You've got a gap where you can do that. And I think that you could probably make that work as another way of getting into the impossible measurement business. But not all algebraic quantum field theories are described quite like that. And in an abstract setting, you've got no real reason to assume that you could take an observable part. It might just have its localization across the whole of B, and there's nothing you can do about it. And if you, and it does not decompose as a sum of something that's mostly over here and mostly over there. Okay, and probably a Wilson loop would be an example of something that just wouldn't, you know, sum in an appropriate way. So, you know, it does depend on the theory, what sort of observables you're talking about. And that's why one of the important things about what we've done is it doesn't make very many assumptions about the theory. So the main one really is this causal factorization, that essentially the separate probes can be can have their dynamics factorized.
Kaju, can I ask the last question? You're muted.
Yes, sorry. Yes, go ahead.
So for gauge theories, would I expect there's any meaningful observable that obey the nice properties?
Yes.
If Wilson loop is not, what is?
Well, anything that, so now you would need to say, let's make a coupling. Okay, so it's an interesting question, right? Take a gauge theory, which I don't think we haven't done. Take a gauge theory and make a coupling between that and some other theory. Right? Then all of the formalism should apply, and you ought to be able to compute the induced map. Now, it's going to be more complicated because the model we've analyzed in detail is effectively a non-interacting one because all the equations of motion are linear. And in what we're doing here, you would actually, you know, inevitably would end up as an interacting model. But in principle, this could be computed. Exactly what those observables are, I'm not sure off the top of my head, but I would expect that there are some interesting ones to be had.
Thanks.
More questions from people not called Raphael?
Yeah, maybe I have one question.
Okay.
So I'm, I guess it's similar to all the other questions. For me, what's very interesting about this is that, like, in principle, it might allow you to do characterization of all the allowed observables in the theory without having to talk about this extended theory where you're adding fields. Not just like if you start in the normal quantum mechanics thing and say allowed measurements are like these unitary purifications, and then you derive, okay, so quantum instruments or something like this. But here is there anything you can say about the space of allowed observables? Like, it seems to me, it's not even obvious that they form an algebra, right? The addition right. is not operationally meaningful, and probably you would even expect them not to form a vector space, right?
Okay, they do. Okay, and the reason that they form a vector space is because epsilon sigma is linear. Okay, if I find the formula, there we are. There's the formula for epsilon sigma. Theta is a linear map. So it's actually an algebra automorphism, but it's a linear map. And this eta sigma, which is the only other bit, this is defined as a linear map, linearly extending the map that sends P tensor Q to expectation on of sigma Q times P. Okay, so that can be extended as a linear map to this tensor product. And so the overall map epsilon sigma is definitely linear. It is not a homomorphism. So at this point, it isn't clear, you're right, that it's an algebra. It does contain the unit because we prove the unit gets mapped to unit. Now, now we skip to the almost the end of the talk. what you can do, because you now have formula for epsilon sigma on this generating function, really quite explicitly. And this allows you to define a deformed product on the probe theory in such a way that epsilon sigma is turned into a homomorphism. Okay, and you'll find this in the paper with Reiner in Communications and Mathematical Physics. So you can change the product on the probe theory so that this map epsilon sigma is a homomorphism. And the image of a homomorphism is a subalgebra. So definitely this epsilon sigma image is a unital subalgebra of the system algebra. Okay.
I didn't understand everything, but I get the point that the map from the sort of POVM element on the Ancilla field theory to the sort of original theories is a linear one. Wanted to say about it's more maybe more basic. The thing I'm thinking of is like if you look at a system of two qubits and you say, okay, what are the allowed operators consistent with locality? Maybe you're going to say, okay, it's a tensor products of local operators. And then if you say that's my set of allowed observables, they do not form a vector space, because if you start adding them together, then you can just make any operator, right? Mm-hmm. So there's that's more, I guess, the direction of the question I was trying to say. If you have two observables, you know you could make both of them. It doesn't imply you could make the sum of them, mm-hmm. Even though the map you have is linear.
Okay, so there is a recent paper by Walter Moretti in Letters in Mathematical Physics. I think maybe Drago is co-author and Mazzucci, where they discuss the operational meaning of the sum of non-commuting operators. So I would point you in that direction for some new perspective on that one. And otherwise, here, I think what we're trying to get away from a little bit is the idea of just saying, well, let's suppose we have two qubits. Let's suppose we have an interaction like this. Let's actually say, let's take quantum field theory and let's make fairly minimal assumptions about quantum field theory and see what that then says. Okay, so it's really trying to work, not to reinvent anything, but just to work with the quantum field theory that we more or less know.
Yeah, thank you. I just like my small comment is that anything you can do with qubits, you expect that it would be able to happen in a subspace of the quantum field theory, right? So
you would,
it's not
you would hope
like
so,
you want to find course. More constraints, not less.
Yes, but not everything you can do in quantum mechanics is actually something that you can do in quantum field theory. Okay, there are some subtle differences. And actually, one of the things that Kasia and I tried to do in our introduction to AQFT was to try to highlight some of the ways in which quantum mechanics and quantum field theory are actually somewhat different in what you can and cannot do. So you might find some of that amusing. To look at.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for the question. So I'm aware that we have been talking here for half an hour already. So I think it's fair to sort of finish officially and let people go and maybe continue this discussion still if we can use this Zoom room. Josh, are we allowed to stay here?
Yeah, you can.
Okay. Yeah. So I would just give this brief opportunity for some people to have a graceful exit, and then we can continue the discussion. So Rafael can ask even more questions. So let me just thank Chris again.